Hello and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions, either that you've left in the comments section of my Q&A videos or have sent to me at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. I've got some great questions this week that we're going to be taking up, but first I wanted to just give a couple comments. This last week, I was at the Skeptics of Oz conference out in Wichita, Kansas last weekend. It went wonderfully. It went really, really great. And that video is now up. So if you want to see that, it's called Scientology, Why Smart People Fall for Stupid Things. And it was a lot of fun to give that. And there's also some Q&A in there. It's not just that lecture goes about 40 minutes or so. And then there was a Q&A section, which I think a lot of you might be very interested in seeing. So you can check that out. I've been amused over the last couple weeks to see Scientology ads showing up on my videos. And the reason for that is not because they are targeting me and not because I'm, you know, trying to get those ads. It's simply because YouTube assigns ads to videos based on how they're tagged or indexed. And of course, my videos are indexed under Scientology because that's what I'm talking about. So the YouTube's algorithms assign Scientology ads to my videos automatically. And I cannot be more amused by that because, of course, that means Scientology's kind of paying me to talk about them. Scientology lately has been involved, apparently, in some pretty big internet ad buys, which have had the amusing results of not only showing up on my videos, but also even as there were some Scientology ads showing up on some homosexual dating sites, which I thought was absolutely fascinating. So apparently they're not putting a lot of control in on where those advertising dollars are being spent by the companies that are placing those ads. And it's all just, you know, sort of Scientology PR 101 in that they just, you know, mess it up over and over and over again. So anyway, a little musing there. And one last thing I wanted to say is stick around until the very end of the show because I have a surprise shout out that I'm going to be doing at the end of this show that I think you'll be interested in. And I want to get right onto the questions now, so we're gonna get into those. Layla Rafat, was Hubbard's weird book, Excalibur, ever printed out? The book being referred to was a work that Hubbard wrote in the 30s, if I recall correctly. And I've actually been looking into that a little bit lately for research on my book. And it's an interesting and very, very important book, actually, a work that Hubbard wrote, because it was the first thing he wrote that had to do with life and philosophy and how people act and get along and whatnot. And it was never published. And in fact, from all accounts I can find, there are only 3 copies of the book in existence, all in Scientology's archives up in, you know, Hemet, California. They're not available anywhere. And the book has never been published or reproduced. Sections of it have. I think a chapter of it was in one of the Ron mags, one of the magazines, the biographical magazines that the church has put out about Ron. There's a chapter in the Educator, Ron the Educator mag, that they said comes out of Excalibur. Kind of hard to read, kind of weighty stuff. There are non-Scientologists who have attested to the fact that the book exists. Apparently the first person to ever read it was Arthur J. Burks. He was another author at the time that Hubbard was when they were writing pulps, and they were acquaintances. Burks actually describes in an article the book and what he remembered of it. The article was written in like 61 or something. But that's, you know, you can dig that up online. And then also Hubbard's literary agent, Forrest Ackerman, also discusses the book and some of its history and whatnot. And there's all kinds of myth and lore connected with it that Hubbard liked to you know, promote. You know, people who committed suicide after reading it because it was so powerful and amazing and this sort of thing. And he talked about it, sort of dropped hints about it in lectures every now and again, but he never released it. I think the book was important because it was a turning point in Hubbard's life when he had this sudden realization. Apparently he had been having some dental surgery, gone under and died, or, you know, had a near-death experience. And during the course of that, had this, you know, this imagined that he had this whole incident happen to him where he'd gone off into some tunnel of light or whatnot and been exposed to all of this fantastic information that, you know, people aren't supposed to normally have, and had come back from that and had immediately gone and run off and taken a week and written this book in a fury. And it explains that, you know, the principle of existence, the thing that drives us all to exist, is to survive, and our survival, you know, and being. So anyway, this was for him very, very important. And nobody published it at the time. He couldn't get anybody to publish it. And I understand he was quite disappointed by that and quite upset about it, but he never gave up on it and he never let it go. And so he said elements of it survived into Dianetics and Scientology. And I happen to believe him about that. I think he thought it was very important stuff. So that's what I can tell you about Excalibur. Public interest. In an earlier answer you gave about OT3, you said, again, this is all within the Scientology belief system, and go on to clarify Hubbard's unoriginal idea that the identity of a person is a spiritual thing not confined to the physical universe. Hubbard claims a thetan becomes trapped in the physical universe. So if it wasn't aliens getting transported into volcanoes per Hubbard's imagined fantasy, what do you think it was? What did they identify with? What was in the ice cubes? A thetan trapped in a what, if it wasn't an alien life form? I think Hubbard's myth needs exploding, but not in a cartoon like South Park. Of course, nothing was trapped in any ice cube or transported anywhere. That was Hubbard's insanity, but it persists and the cognitive dissonance persists. Okay, well, you are asking me to clarify Hubbard's fantasies, so, you know, I don't know that there's a whole lot of right and wrong with this, and I've got the information I have about it from what I've read. I didn't do OT3, but what I understand from what I did get in Scientology in terms of your question is, Hubbard said that thetans, or spiritual beings, were not matter, energy, space, or time. They were not something that had any substance or mass or wavelength or location in time or space. So they didn't exist in terms we understand, and yet they exist. So the way that they locate themselves in space or time is by identifying themselves with things, namely bodies, right? A thetan will assume ownership and control of a body before or at its birth, and will think of himself or itself as that body. That is what the thetan thinks it is. And Hubbard, one of Hubbard's claims about Scientology was that thetans over the centuries, over the millennia, had degraded in their own ability and perception and understanding of themselves to the point where they truly thought that this was all there was to their existence. And they habitually identified themselves with bodies or with people, with things. And of course, if they degraded far enough down where they couldn't even, you know, be awake or aware enough to have and own a body and have a life like you and I do, then they degraded down into, you know, being a table or a rock or something or an animal. Or, as you learn when you get on the OT levels, they become a body thetan. They degrade down into a near-death state for a spiritual being where it has no real awareness of itself anymore at all and is barely awake and is just sort of glommed onto, you know, in these clusters of body thetans. And the way Hubbard explained it in terms of having this location or having a place in time and space is the thetan basically just considers that it does. You know, it thinks that it's in a location, and so there it is in that location, viewing things from that place or that time. And Hubbard never really got into variable time streams. which is, of course, you know, would be kind of fascinating if a Thetan could move up and down a time stream and consider that it was in 1812 looking at things, and bam, it's in 1812 looking at things. You know, wouldn't that be something? That kind of deep thought never really enters into the Scientology mythology that I'm aware of. I never ran into any kind of thinking like that. But it certainly, he didn't certainly explain it in terms of space, spatial location, right? He very clearly said that, you know, if a Thetan considers that he's in China, bam, he's in China, you know? And that's how they would have a location. So the combination of these two things is degraded, you know, spiritual being who considers that it is a body, and so therefore that is its location. Now, when I was saying earlier that, you know, it wasn't space aliens, you know, that had come down to Earth or whatever, I guess I was taking exception to the word alien because, you know, you get the idea of, you know, movie monsters or, you know, aliens or something. I mean, strictly speaking, if it's not of this Earth, it is alien. So, yeah, you know, but Hubbard describes, you know, whole track, you know, civilizations, galactic civilizations in the years past, whole track meaning back many, 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 many years ago, like thousands and millions and billions of years ago. Hubbard describes civilizations where the bodies were just like or very much like the ones that are on Earth now. So, you know, this form of body is apparently common all around the universe. It's not the only kind of body that exists in the universe. Hubbard also described all kinds of other bodies, including non-organic bodies. He called them doll bodies. Imagine like a Terminator and a spiritual being assuming control of a Terminator body. That would be a doll body, right? It's a machine. It's made specifically to house, you know, a Thetan. So that was part of the cosmology and mythology that Hubbard came up with too, was doll bodies. So, and then he also talked about other kinds of bodies, snake bodies, cat bodies, you know, all kinds of different things. So he basically, you know, sort of left everything open to the widest possible interpretation. So basically, if you went into an auditing session in Scientology and imagined something happened to you 4 trillennia ago, it would fit within his cosmology somewhere. So that's kind of how that all works. And I hope all of that answers your question. Rebel, I know that Hubbard and Scientologists despise gays. Did you meet, hear about any gays on staff? If so, can you tell how were they treated or their stories? And or do you know anyone claiming to be cured of homosexuality through Scientology? Thank you very much. While I was on staff, I did encounter homosexuals who were practicing Scientology or wanted to do Scientology and get to clear and OT. And the way that was basically dealt with was they were encouraged to stop practicing, that you couldn't be a practicing homosexual if you wanted to do Scientology services. And the idea was that by doing Scientology services and moving up the grade chart, the bridge, you would eventually resolve that homosexuality, because in Scientology, they don't hate gays. They consider that gays have a mental illness, or are, the word they use is aberrated, right? In other words, they're, because of the, you know, reactive mind, or because of their, you know, their crap that they've been through in the past, there are engrams, or there are things telling them to be gay, and that that through Scientology and through going up the bridge and becoming clear in OT, those things will resolve and they won't want to be gay anymore. They won't be gay anymore. That's the kind of the viewpoint within Scientology about gays. It's not really a like or a dislike or a hate or anything like that. It's more that they think that they are aberrated or that they are mentally unsound. And, you know, some hate can be generated from that, of course, or dislike or disgust and that sort of thing. And Hubbard's descriptions of it, of course, you know, reinforce that. Now, I do know of somebody who was in Santa Barbara. He was a hairdresser and he was very gay. And I mean, he spoke with a lisp. He had, you know, wild clothes and wild hair and all that. He was very openly homosexual. And he wanted very much to do Scientology, and so he, you know, stopped practicing it. And he got up to a point where he said he was no longer a homosexual after doing a lot of Scientology. And they did certain auditing techniques on him to address the homosexuality and address his sexual behavior and sexual deviancy, or however they put it, so that he would stop having any desires or urges to, you know, want to have sex with men. So he claimed that that worked. I knew another woman who was a lesbian who didn't really see a problem with being a lesbian, wasn't particularly practicing, wasn't particularly restraining herself from practicing, but she wanted to do Scientology, and she had done the lower bridge and gotten up to a point where it came time for her to start receiving the confidential stuff. And that's the point where they draw the line in Scientology on you not moving forward anymore. Now, I can't speak for John Travolta, of course, or, you know, rumors about his bisexuality or homosexuality, because I don't know. I just have no idea. But I do know from my own experience that if you had homosexual tendencies or urges, you were not going to be allowed to go onto those OT levels or go into any confidential information. They would consider you a security risk, and they couldn't trust you, because Hubbard said that homosexuals are not to be trusted. So, so you had to be cured before you were going to be allowed to involve yourself in any kind of confidential upper-level material in Scientology. They'll let you do the lower bridge stuff, and they'll work you while you're doing those things to handle your urges. And that's how they expect to cure you, is through the auditing and through training, meaning you're reading Hubbard's books and his lectures and that sort of thing, and supposed to come to some kind of form of enlightenment where you won't feel that way anymore. So it's not, you know, pray the gay away, it's sort of study the gay away and say the gay away. In other words, you're talking your way out of it by doing the counseling. So that's how Scientology works with that. And those are the two most, the ones I remember right off the top of my head, cases that I encountered personally. Glenn Anderson. Everything is always your fault. It always comes back to your responsibility. If this is the group mindset or culture within Scientology, how would you square it with the decline of the church vis-a-vis David Miscavige? At what point will he be forced to accept that the decline is happening on his watch and that he, as supreme leader, is ultimately responsible for it? Maybe another way to put it is, when will DM realize that he has pulled in what has been happening to Scientology over the past 6 or 8 years? Exodus of top leaders, growing number of critics, decline in membership. Isn't he ultimately responsible? What is not generally being recognized in the context of this question is that David Miscavige and L. Ron Hubbard before him were infallible. Their will, their what they want done, is called command intention. And it's everybody else's job under them to follow command intention and get it done. So David Miscavige is not responsible for any failure of any kind, because he's infallible. And nothing he says or does could be possibly wrong. And he's not going to accept the burden of responsibility for Scientology's declining numbers or, you know, PR foot bullets or any of that stuff, because he can always have somebody below him that he can blame for that. That the blame game in Scientology, the responsibility that you're always responsible for your own condition, is a mental control mechanism that's used in Scientology to keep people constantly on their toes, constantly on pins and needles, and under threat or duress of punishment at any time. It's not a point that David Miscavige is ever going to be held to, because nobody's ever going to look at David Miscavige and go, within the bubble world, and look at him and say, hey, you know, dear leader, your leadership sucks because look at what's happening, and Scientology is going downhill and it's all on you. No one's ever going to say that to David Miscavige, not and get away with it. Instead, he's the one who says that to his juniors, and they push it down the line to their juniors, and so on and so on and so on down the line. And so it's all the lesser people below the leadership that are subjected to that treatment. So that's how that works. And you will never, ever see Hubbard or Miscavige blamed for any of Scientology's ills. Mandy Franks. Hi, Chris. After listening to many people who were traumatized by Scientology and eventually came out after some pretty heartbreaking turn of events, losing everything, being physically hurt, losing family, almost all of them have specifically said, "Don't feel sorry for me," and "It bothers me when I meet people and they tell me I'm sorry." That seems to be a theme. No one wants to feel like a charity case, but many people did come through some horrible things, and it will compel people. Why does this seem to be such running commentary? This is a really good question, and the reason why people coming out of Scientology, maybe other destructive cults too, I've not seen this particular phenomena out of other cults, but Scientology for sure has a very specific doctrine of not being a victim. Hubbard was very down on the idea of being a victim, and a victim is a bad word in Scientology. You don't ever play the victim card in Scientology. No one ever did anything to you that is, something that deserves them being chastised particularly. I mean, within reason. I mean, sure, there's, you know, if a father's beating on his kid, you know, nobody's going to go, "Hey, kid, it's all your fault." I mean, they are reasonable people to a degree. But the spirit and attitude of Scientology is very much not to play the victim card and to not be a victim and to be responsible for your own condition. In an ultimate sense, you could twist that to mean that that kid who was getting beaten by his father was responsible for it. And kind of inside their heads, Scientologists will kind of think that. But at the same time, you know, nobody's going to go that far out of their way to say that the kid was responsible for his dad beating him. However, when you're an adult, you know, you start moving up in the world where you become of age and you are being held responsible for your life, victimology, any victimness is totally canceled, right? You either pulled it in because of bad things that you did or, basically that's pretty much the idea, is that if something bad happens to you, it's your fault because you pulled it in. And you pulled it in because you did something prior to that that you shouldn't have been doing. So, for example, to a Scientologist way of thinking, if a guy got hit by a car, then you might, you know, sit him down and inquire as to what he was up to before he got hit by the car. Maybe not right before he got hit by the car, maybe so. But before that time, was he doing something bad? Was he doing something wrong? Was there somebody, in his life who was giving him a hard time and stuff that he was going to be, you know, that he felt victimized by? And if so, what was he doing to that guy, right? That's basically all roads lead back to you. And all thinking goes back to, what did you do to create that unideal situation in your life? Because in the end, you are responsible for your own condition. That kind of thinking, right, that you are responsible, takes a long time to shed when you get out of the cult. You can see why Hubbard would want to indoctrinate his followers and why Miscavige would very definitely want to follow that kind of doctrine, because it means it's always somebody else's fault, kind of like what I was answering with the last question. It creates a mindset in the people who are being victimized that they aren't really victims, and they aren't really being victimized. It's all on them. And that's very important to the mind control that goes on in Scientology. Especially, most of this that I'm talking about here really heavily applies in the C organization. At the public level and at the staff level, it's a lesser degree of this. It's still there, but it's not as heavily enforced. On the C org, it's 100% enforced. So when you get out, you know, like I did or other people did, this took a really long time. This took months and months and months for me to even get my head starting to think around the idea that I was not personally responsible for every single bad thing that ever happened to me, and that, you know, life happens and shit happens, and sometimes you're just having a bad day, and sometimes lightning strikes and it's nobody's fault, you know. It took me a long time to overcome that. This was something that Hubbard started pushing down the line as early as 1952, this responsibility thing. He first wrote about it then, and it was in 1959 and 1960 that he really picked it up and really started drumming it in hard, because I think it was at that time that he realized what an awesome control mechanism it was. So that's why people in Scientology who come out will say things like that, and eventually, I think, with work, you know, if they work at it, they'll overcome that and come to realize that that they were victimized, and that's something that they kind of need to acknowledge as part of the healing process. Barbara Henninger, Chris, could you explain in detail and with some examples how it is that Scientologists are supposed to be saving the world? In the Scientology bubble world, they have various ideas of how they're going about doing this, mainly through their Scientology front groups, like the Way to Happiness Foundation, or their Applied Scholastics, or the Narconon program, where they're addressing directly the ills of society by handling education or drug addiction or criminality through the Criminon program. They have these front groups that reach out into society and are supposed to be handling these things. Of course, any Google search will tell you right away that none of that work is effective, and in fact the whole Narconon drug addiction handling program is itself very destructive and not at all an effective program that you want to be pushing on people. Because it's just dangerous, you know, as I've laid out and others have, you know, in terms of what the program consists of. So, but in the bubble world, they all think that stuff's really effective and really workable, and they're actually saving lives by doing that stuff. So that's one way that they think that they are dealing with and saving the world. But the bigger picture for Scientologists is actually through the auditing that they do, the counseling. Scientologists have this idea of theta and n-theta. Okay, now what do those words mean? Theta is life force, okay? Theta is positive life force. It is spiritual essence, and it's good. You know, you imagine a white, glowy energy, you know, it's not really that way. I'm just telling you how I always thought of it, was this sort of white, glowy energy that was life force. And theta is what makes all things live, not just people, but it animates all of life. Plants, animals, ants, everything that is alive because it's imbued with some degree of theta, okay? That's a quantity. It's a life force. It doesn't, as I mentioned in the first question, I think, on this Q&A, it's not something that exists in this world. It has existence, but it's not matter, energy, space, or time. It's not a kind of energy. It's just spiritual life force. So they call that theta. And then there is n-theta, or interpolated theta, or messed up theta. And that's kind of a black, massy sort of thing, right? And that's when the theta gets messed up by life. You know, life happens to us. We get in accidents. We die. We are victimized. We're abused. We have things happen to us. And that theta, that natural life force that exists within us, becomes encrusted and nasty and cynical and bad. And that's N-theta, okay? And Scientology auditing is supposed to be converting N-theta into theta, because the theta is still there. It's all just crunched up and messed up and black and horrible, right? And so, and this is, you know, this is not some like new concept. I mean, this happens in movies and whatnot. If you imagine Scrooge as an example that comes to mind of like this N-theta, gnarly, horrid, you know, cranky old guy, and he's bent over with the weight of all of his N-theta, you know, literally it's bending him over because it's so heavy. You know, and then through the course of the story, that N theta is converted to theta. He becomes young and lively again. Not young, but younger looking. You know, every adaptation of the Christmas Carol always shows him at the end jumping around and springing about and looking like he's all rehabilitated. That's an example of N theta being converted to theta. Okay, think I made that clear. Scientology's mission is to get as many people audited with Scientology as possible to convert all their N theta back into theta. And the idea, what they describe in Scientology, is the theta-N theta ratio, where the world as a whole has a certain quantity of N theta, if you could measure it, like in pounds or something, right? They don't measure it in pounds, but I'm just saying, you know, there's a quantity of this, right? There's only so much N theta that exists. But the world is all screwed up right now, according to Scientology, because of all the N theta. And so the idea is to tip the scale, to undo the N theta and turn it into theta, so that there's more theta than there is N theta. And by doing that, the world will be this wonderful, gallopy, butterflies and rainbows kind of place. That's kind of how they imagine it, right? And the other thing about this is that as every time you are going in session in Scientology, you're getting counseling or auditing, you're releasing, you know, more and more of this N theta into theta for yourself, right? But the way the analogy works in Scientology is as you progress on the bridge, the higher up you go, the more theta you are releasing per unit of time in session. So they talk about this in Scientology. This is a talked about known thing, right? They say that, for example, when you first go into session, they say if all of your N theta was a beach of sand, right? Just take a mile by, you know, mile beach, and that's your amount of N theta when you first walk into Scientology. When you first start going in session, you're handling that N theta with a tablespoon. You know, you take a little scoop and I've handled this much, right? And that's how much you're handling every time you go in session. It's just a little tiny bit, not much. But it seems like a lot because you've never handled any of this sand before, any of this N theta. And so it's, you know, so it's all releasing, right? And it's wonderful and you feel great. But you can't see like that you've got this whole, you know, beach to deal with. Well, what happens is as you progress up the line, you go clear and you start going on to the OT levels. Well, they say that your spoon turns into a shovel, turns into a bulldozer as you're moving up the line. And so every session that you have when you're on the OT levels, at the upper levels of Scientology, like OT3, where the Xenu thing happens, when you get to that level, you're driving a bulldozer on that beach, moving massive amounts of sand. You're converting tons of N theta into theta very quickly. And that's why they say in Scientology that they want you to get up to those OT levels as quickly as possible and do them, because the more people that do them, the less N theta there is in the world that's affecting everybody. Because the other thing they say is that when you're at those OT levels, you're handling N theta that affects everybody, not just you. I hope all of that makes sense. Because that whole analogy I just told you is something they talk about in Scientology, and it is how they think they're going to save the world. That's the story they tell themselves, is through this mystical, magical thinking of converting N theta into theta. So that's why also you don't see a lot of Scientologists feeling the need to go out into the world and do practical, real things to deal with the problems of the world, because they think that they're going to handle the world from inside their auditing rooms. They don't have to go out in the world and change it. They're changing it from sitting right there doing their auditing. And they will use confirmation bias to reinforce this belief. In other words, if somebody goes in session and they, you know, have some big win and they're all happy. And their grandmother calls them and says, hey, I've been getting that chemotherapy and turns out the cancer is gone into remission. They will literally think to themselves, that cancer went into remission because I went in session. That's what they tell themselves, right? Is they had an effect on the world outside of themselves because of the auditing that they received. So that's how they think they're saving the world, and that's why they act the way they act. All right, I think we went a little bit long today because I was kind of getting into some of those answers, but I hope you found those useful and entertaining. And I wanted to end the show here with a quick shout out to a very special person to me. I don't do shout outs. I've never done anything like this before, but there's a YouTube channel that I want to refer you guys to, and it is Guy with a Wheel 23. This is the YouTube channel of Joshua Tyndall. And Joshua Tyndall is my son, and he lives in Australia, and he's a great guy, and he's a filmmaker, and he makes YouTube videos. He hasn't made a lot of them, but he's made some, and they are films. They're not videos like I make, and I think they're pretty unique and pretty interesting, and I am going to put a link right here to them, so check it out. Most of the videos are also pretty short. They're 5-10 minute long, so it's not a big commitment to go check them out. But I think he deserves the look, and I'm curious what y'all think about that. So anyway, check it out. Thank you very much for watching, and I will see you next week.